Welcome to History 101, Lecture 7, The Classical Age of Islam. Well, Europe was, as I said in the previous lecture, spared the benefits or curse of rule by dynasties deriving from steppe nomads. India, for the first time, because the previous Pathan dynasties arriving from Afghanistan, and Pathans are tough-minded, hardy, independent mountain folk who resent any form of authority, a kind of ancient Swiss of Asia, except that they have remained exactly like the ancient Swiss to this very day, but are definitely not steppe nomads. The Balkans and the Arab countries, by lack of any better word, Iran, and ultimately China, under the Manchu, Qing dynasty, all lapsed under the rules of nomads. Though, actually, the Manchu were not steppe nomads either, but by origin, a shifting cultivation, hunter-gatherer people, that came from the southernmost extension of the great Siberian taiga, in what is now Russian Manchuria, beyond the Usudu River. The oldest of those dynasties was the Ottoman Empire, originally established by a band of Oghuz Turkish warriors in Anatolia under Osman I in 1289. It was essentially constructed by Sultan Murad, who boldly crossed from Anatolia into the Balkans. And there, after the famous defeat of the Serbian army at Kosovo in 1398, constructed a new Islamic state on the ruin of the Byzantine Empire and of its Balkan allies. This Osman dynasty gained unrivaled prestige after capturing Constantinople in 1453. After all, Islamic armies had attempted to conquer Constantinople since the 7th century. It was in fact an event that used to be seen as the beginning of modern history itself, and with good reasons. It after all terminated the Roman Empire that had dominated, if not European politics, then European imagination for more than 1,000 years. And furthermore, it demoted Greek, that had once been spoken from Sicily to the Hindu Kush, to the status of insignificant provincial language, a demoticon, spoken merely by a few provincial hillbillies. The conquest of Constantinople was followed by the equally momentous conquest of the Mamluk Kingdom in Egypt in 1517 and the defeat of the Kingdom of Hungary at the Battle of Mohács in 1526. The Kingdom of Hungary was thus in 1533 divided between Austria, that obtained present Slovenia. Slovenia is still another Austria, merely with a different language. An Hungarian dynasty that ruled over Transylvania, presently part of Romania, as a vassal state of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire that ruled Buda and the central Hungarian Pushta. The conquest of Egypt was not only of vast economic significance, but also allowed the Ottoman Sultan to claim the title of Khalif, that had so far been claimed by the Mamluks. The Safavid Empire was a newer creation. It was established by the teenager son of a dynasty of wardens of a prestigious Islamic shrine in Ardabil, present Iranian Azerbaijan, Ismail. The Safavids were the leaders of a kind of combined Sufi or Islamic saint order and an illegal Shia resistance movement, Zaidia, and Ismail proclaimed himself to be both Shah and something pretty much approaching the Messiah in 1500. In a group of dramatic campaigns from 1504 to 1512, he managed to subdue present Iran and parts of Afghanistan, and officially and critically proclaimed Iran to be a Shiite state. The Mughal Empire, finally, was created by a grandson of Tamerlane, Zayed-ud-Din Babur, hereditary ruler of Ferghana. Babur was bested from his old seats of Ferghana and Samarkand by a newcomer from the north and another descendant of Genghis Khan, Muhammad Shaybanidgan Uzbek, in 1498. More or less by coup de main, captured Kabul in 1504, and in 1522, by skillful use of a new weapon, mobile artillery, managed to defeat the ruling Afghan Lodi dynasty of Delhi, though the Mughals never managed to reconquer their ancestral lands of Samarkand and Ferghana again, that remained under the Uzbek dynasty. All these dynasties, even after they had become completely settled and became almost identical to their capitals, Isfahan, Delhi or Istanbul, all three amongst the largest cities of the 17th century world, and all three the epithet of urban sophistication, still tried preserving their origins in the steppes, in the games they played. Polo, an import from the Mughal Empire to Europe. In the languages they talked, modern-day Azerbaijan Turkish for the Safavids, or present Uzbek Turkish for the Mongols. And though the Ottomans, by 1500, mostly stayed in Istanbul, the other two constantly moved around the country, in vast encampments, thousands of tents. The most gorgeous ones, the kind of mobile palaces they had inherited from the Mongols. And finally, they remained nomadic in their institutions, which, in the Mughal case, were largely Mongol-derived. As in the way of ranking by decimals of number of horses that the Mughals used, the Mansab system, a system adapted from the Mongol Tumen system. Now there were three problems for these kind of empires that originally derived from steppe, and all three were sketched by the great Tunisian scholar Ibn Khaldun in the 15th century. For although Khaldun was writing about the Berbers and relations between them and kingdoms on the coast of North Africa, what he wrote about kingdoms in the Maghreb to some extent applied to those originating in Central Asia, too. There was, however, a clear difference, too. And that was how they had to deal with the large, highly literate elites that had ruled those countries before they came for thousands of years. North Africa was obviously too poor to afford anything like that. The bureaucracy of the Byzantine Empire for the Ottomans, the Indian Brahmins for the Mughals, to very much simplify, for there was in India, of course, already a highly literate Islamic elite since the 13th century, or the Persian-speaking urban elites for the Safavids. Such elites were obviously indispensable for raising taxes. And furthermore, an empire could drive some of those older elites to the wall, but if you pressed all of them too hard, you might face a very large revolt, which would be very difficult to repress. The Osmanis, the Mughals, and the Safavids had us all to accommodate to and work with and through those older elites. Though admittedly, in the Balkans, the old Serbian or Bulgarian aristocracy was by and large eliminated by the Osmanis, and their land partly allotted to tenant farmers, partly allotted to Ottoman soldiers, who were called timarios, and who could then levy taxes on the peasants, and had to maintain a couple of horses. In principle, such fiefs were not hereditary. In practice, by the 17th century, they commonly were. In Asia Minor, the Osmanlis gradually absorbed the older Byzantine bureaucracy until these had become thoroughly Osmanli. But they followed a different policy with the older Mamluk elites and literati, who more or less all stayed where they were. In Syria and Iraq, there was above all continuity between Mamluks and Ottomans. Though of Turkish descent, the Safavids became gradually Persianized, particularly by reintroducing the intricate court ritual they had taken over from ancient Iran and that had lapsed during the Mongol and previous Black Sheep dynasty rule, until, by 1700, the Safavids were seen by most of the Persian population as accepted national rulers. And I think this word national is by 1700 quite legitimate for Persia, that by then had very definite features of a national state. Whence too, the disappearance of the Safavids created a sort of void. None of the later rulers had their legitimacy, and they often posed as a kind of stand-in for the legitimate Safavid ruler. This too created a permanent cleft between the clergy and any Iranian Khan or Shah, as basically the clergy now began to see themselves as the spokesman for the population against a set of rulers whose claim to the throne always rested on very shaky foundations, whereas they had previously, under Safavid rule, been closely integrated into the bureaucracy through the uniquely Safavid office of the Khalif al-Khulafa, supreme overseer of the Islamic rule. In the Mughal Empire, finally, there was a kind of shadow administration. The emperors claimed they were exercising absolute rule, just as Louis XIV might claim he did, over an Islamic state. In practice, local administration came down on a mainly Hindu administration, and on all kinds of small, local Hindu chiefs, kings, potentates, who would claim they obeyed the emperor, but did ever more as they pleased, the further they were away from Delhi, aside from which there were still a great many powerful Hindu dynasties, such as the mighty Rathors of Jodhpur, who were commonly allied to the Mughal Empire by marriage, or because they had family members staying at the court, half of hostages, half as a kind of internees, who were sent there to pick up good manners. Emperor Aurangzeb actually even tried to make a Mughal out of the son of his most bitter enemy, Shambhaji Bhonsle, by keeping him at court, which actually worked so well that when his father had died, and he returned to his old seat, Pune, he had so much changed beyond recognition that the tough Maratha warriors were completely unable to fathom his new civilized manner. Now to return to Ibn Khaldun. The first problem, Ibn Khaldun argues, was the rulership of the Bedouin, and for that matter of steppe nomads, was viziparous. Bedouin, or steppe nomadic societies, are far more egalitarian than agrarian societies, and they obey by example. Simply put, with nomads, the kind of claim that I am the hereditary ruler over on which European states were built makes no impression whatsoever. You have to show nomads you're worthy of being a ruler by shooting wolves or tigers
or heck, fight a tiger or wolf yourself. You've got to have many children, so that the impotent, as well as childish, Spanish ruler Charles II would never have become leader of a nomadic tribe, and you have to prove yourself by brave deeds in war. The Khan always has to storm the walls himself first. And last but not least, you have to richly reward your followers. They were tough men. But oddly, they were very cultured men too. After storming some city, and erecting pyramids of skulls of the captives, they would next engage in poetry contests, where the one who had made the best rhyme would be rewarded the captured gold or the captured slave girls. Now if a ruler did not satisfy such expectations on the battlefield, and all too often also in the poetry contest, there will immediately be a horde of pretenders to the crown, ready to revolt against him. The problem, however, was that the rulers, once they had conquered a settled area, were now surrounded by the bureaucrats from the conquered territory, bureaucrats who had a tradition of hereditary kingship, and the Persian kingly tradition goes all the way back to Babylon, and they tended to praise the new king to the skies, as well as shelter him within his new court as much as possible. His nomadic followers would interpret this as corruption. Something like, before we had conquered Delhi, I could walk into my beloved Khan's tent whenever I wanted, but now I have to go to hordes of functionaries. Thus, the various groups would tend to split up in parties and groupings, who were always immediately willing to back any pretender to the throne. The Safavids and the Ottomans solved that particular problem, but the remedy was worse than the disease. They permanently locked potential successors away in the imperial harem. This also means that you lock somebody up for decades amongst a few hundred, particularly irritable women, as they are not likely to see their husband very much, who spend their whole day doing their hair, and the rest of the time boring themselves, quarreling and intriguing who would get their son on the throne. Not likely the best education for somebody who is then supposed to become army commander or supreme judge. In addition, putting somebody in a cramped room with lots of people coming in and out is a recipe for getting tuberculosis, and a whole series of Mughal rulers died of tuberculosis. Indeed, several rulers of both the Ottoman Empire and of the Safavids were perhaps best trained or fit to become a hairdresser. The Mughals, by contrast, commonly gave their sons ranking positions in the provinces, so they were mostly much better trained. One reason why the Mughals produced a series of highly capable rulers. But of course those rulers had the whole time to fear for a coup. Shah Jahan, for example, was bested by his son Aurangzeb. He was imprisoned in the fortress at Agra, where he could every day glance at the just completed tomb of his beloved wife, Mumtaz Mahal, called Mahal's Place, or Taj Mahal. Second problem was that Ibn Khaldun argued that nomads made superior warriors to settled people. Not merely because of the superior training in horseback riding or archery, but also as they are used to far more privation than settled folk are. This is pretty obvious. The kind of survival skills which it takes years to drill into a commando or into a ranger come to a nomad naturally. Except, that is, the kind of drill we have been discussing in the previous lecture. Firing musket volleys in close coordination, or later on handling and repairing complicated machines such as guns, because these actions involve a group of automated moves in close coordination with other people, and that you best learn by handling a plow or a machine. However, as nomads settled amongst the urban populations, they are just conquered and in the position of a pampered elite. They became oblivious of their own former martial prowess, and increasingly soft. It was therefore necessary to constantly attract new group of nomads to the Sultan's banners. But these, obviously, tended to become rivals of the group that was already in power. Or even worse, they might become so powerful that they might rise up against the Sultan or the Khan himself. Thus, the court needed a powerful central military to stem discontented tribes. And the traditional way of putting up such a military in Islam was to put up an army of slaves to the Sultan. They would remain devoted to him, as they, after all, were not only his property, but owed everything to him. And slaves of particular merit habitually rose to top-ranking positions in Islamic states, or indeed, they might become rulers themselves, such as the Egyptian Mamluks, or the successors of Qutb ad-Din Ayyubak, creator of the Delhi Sultanate in 1206. Mostly, these slaves came from Georgia and Ukraine, but there were some Africans amongst them too. Such a system of naming slaves to key positions in the administration was still common in the Sultanates of Central India, the Deccan, in the 16th and 17th century. But the Mughals did not use it any longer. Instead, the administration was now staffed by ambitious adventurers, who came from all over Central Asia, Afghanistan, Iraq, or Iran, and with learning or martial skills, could make far larger careers than they ever would make in the Safavid Empire, or amongst the Ottomans. For by 1500, there were already so many Persians or Turks resident in India that people recruited themselves, rather than using the crude head-hunting technique of the Islamic slave trade used previously. For people offered as slaves were always especially selected before being offered for sale to the Sultan. The Mughals could now simply rely on word of mouth in Iraq or Afghanistan for new recruits to join the administration. More or less in pursuance of the old policy, Sultan Murad I created in 1385 a special elite corps of Christian slaves, the new army, or the Janissary, to supplement traditional lefes of provincial governors. The Janissary corps gradually expanded until it became the core of the Ottoman army. At first, soldiers serving in the Janissaries were selected from slaves captured during warfare. However, a new system, commonly known as Defshirme, was adopted later on. In this system, children of rural Christian populations of the Balkan, Albanians, Serbs, Northern Greeks, were conscripted before adolescence and brought up as Muslims. Upon reaching adolescence, these children were then enrolled in one of the four imperial institutions, the palace, the scribes, the religious orders, and the military. Those enrolled in the military would become either part of the Janissary corps or part of another corps, such as the artillery. The brightest were sent to the palace institution, the Andarun, and destined for a career within the palace itself, where the most able might aspire to attain the highest office of state, that of Grand Vizier. The ideal age of a recruit was between 7 and 10 years of age. The Defshirme system was often locally resented, even to the point of disfiguring sons. On the other hand, as Defshirme were recruited to rise up to the highest status in the state, Christian parents in Bosnia were known to bribe scouts to take their children. The Safavids had in the 16th century mainly relied on their tribal cavalry. Called after the red caps with the feathers of the 12 imams they were called the Kizilbash, and they were recruited from various nomadic Turkish-speaking tribes who had supported the Safavid cause, such as the Shamlu and the Ustaçlu. However, during the difficult reign of Shah Tahmasp I, from 1524 to 1572, the great tribal leaders became increasingly independent from the Shah and put themselves more or less up as rulers. To protect the crown, Shah Abbas I, the Great, ruled in the beginning of the 17th century, thus put up a new force, the Ghulam, more or less comparable to the Janissaries, and were, like the Janissaries, partly recruited by children tribute, levied in eastern Georgia, a tributary kingdom of the Safavid Empire then, and partly purchased in Circassia, northern Caucasus region, presently part of Russia. However, those Ghulam forces became never as prominent in the Safavid Empire as the Janissaries were in the Ottoman, partly because there weren't simply that many Christians on the Safavid rule, and partly because the Safavids continued to rely far more on their nomadic cavalry than did the Ottomans, partly because they had a long and uncertain frontier in Afghanistan, which then did not exist as a separate country, and repeatedly switched hands between the Mughal Empire, that commonly dominated Kabul, and the Safavids, who commonly controlled Herat in the west, and they constantly fought the Uzbek Khanats to the north, who raided the Safavid Empire almost annually, and the Uzbek had practically only nomadic cavalry. In addition to which, the Safavids also put up a corps of musket men that was largely recruited from the urban population. The Mughal Empire, finally, was a kind of amalgam, or if you like it, a synthesis between Indian techniques, Uzbek steppe nomadic techniques, and for that matter, some mountaineer Afghan traditions as well. On the one hand, the empire heavily recruited amongst both the warrior elites in present Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, skilled in horse archery and horseback riding, as well as amongst both the Pathans and the Tajiks in present Afghanistan. On the other hand, the empire not only used Indian auxiliary forces, recruited especially among the redoubtable Indian Rajput caste, typically heavy cavalry, while several Rajput commanders became generals in the Mughal Empire, but it also relied, and in the 17th century, had become the mainstay of the army on the so-called Zamindari infantry, a kind of lefay of local landholders. In the 16th century they were mainly archers, but in the 17th century the Zamindari infantry largely consisted of musketeers, as guns were increasingly mass manufactured in India. By the 18th century, there were literally millions of fire weapons around in India. Whatever their precise origin, and whatever difficulties they may have faced, these various dynasties presided over the great age of Islam. The second one, after the so-called classical period of roughly the 8th to the 10th century. And in that period, from the 16th to the 18th century, Islam became so attractive again that tens of millions converted to it without having to use any force commonly. For converting by force was both prohibited by Islamic law, the dhimma, in which other people of other religions of the book were permitted to exercise their own religion freely, and was often not really necessary either. Nor even was it commonly necessary to entice people to convert by offering them positions in the administration, if they only converted. though that certainly helped them, as in Albania. Nowadays, with Bosnia the only Muslim European country, where many converted to attain positions in the Ottoman administration. That was by the 17th century very much dominated by Albanians. This mass conversion to Islam in the early modern period, particularly during the 17th century in India, and from the 15th century onward, in the so far mainly Hindu Indonesian archipelago, and somewhat earlier in modern Malaysia, has had far-reaching consequences.
Typically, if people talk about Islam, they will think about Arabs, the Middle East, or, more dimly, Turkey and Iran. Yet, in effect, the largest Islamic countries now are, in that order, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, and then, probably, since the Nigerian census does not list religion, Nigeria. All these countries, Pakistan excepted, converted to Islam, not only quite recently, but because they have converted so recently, they have also adopted a strongly localized version of Islam, one very different from the Arab one, and sometimes not even Islamic, as in classical Javanese puppet or wayang theater that enact scenes from the Hindu Ramayana, without any attempt to Islamicize it. And in Indonesia, as much as in Nigeria, there's always a certain kind of tension between one group who wants to maintain, even preserve, certain, let's say, folk accruals to Islam, such as wayang, and another group who wants to purify it. Now, as said, almost no force was involved in all these conversions. Both in Bengal and in Indonesia, the prime propagators of the faith were mixed faith healers, Sufi mystics, and the itinerant traders, linked to Islamic Sufi orders, to be sure, but they had mostly no backing of any state in India, and in the Indonesian archipelago, some mere nominal backing of the Ottoman Turks. For the Ottoman Turks gave some support to the militantly Islamic Sultanate of Aceh, that in turn recognized the Ottoman claim to the Caliphate. They were only very reluctantly supported in India, in Bengal, by the local dynasty of the Sultan of Gaur, and even more hesitantly so by the Mughals later on. What made people convert en masse from the book religion of Hinduism, a sophisticated religion as Islam after all, was partly, no doubt, and this is a sensitive matter in India, so I say that with great caution, the very depressed status of the lower castes, who often converted to Islam to escape their utter dejection in the caste system. This may have played a role in Indonesia too. Aside from which, Hinduism appears to have been very much an elite religion in Java, one that had little following amongst the population of the villages. Whereas the central doctrine of Islam, the Ummah, the brotherhood of all believers, had far more appeal. Maybe the reason why the population of Bali, where Hinduism had become a mass religion by the 14th century, did not convert. And Bali has, of course, remained Hindu to the present day. Yet it seems to me too that Islam was militarily, intellectually, culturally, even economically, triumphant religion from the 15th to the 18th century. People were joining a winner in Java in the critical 16th century. And as various small Islamic dynasties arose in Java in the 16th century, united on the Empire of Mataram in the 17th century, Mataram both forcefully and vigorously pursued the further Islamization of Java, sometimes by force, mostly by exile. An impartial observer
in the 17th century would thus by no means have said Islam was on the decline and Europe rising, as might appear much later from the 19th and indeed the 20th century's vantage point. Those two centuries were indeed difficult periods for Islam, worse arguably than the previous bad period of the 13th and 14th century, since after all, the Mongol ruler then had finally converted to Islam, whereas the English, the Dutch, the French or the Russian overlords of the 19th and 20th century did not. Nay, rather branded the whole religion inferior. Such an observer from the 17th century might have argued that though Europe had obtained, admittedly, new territories in the Americas, the new Islamic acquisitions in the Indonesian archipelago had as large a population and were as rich as the Americas. And he might also pointed out that, Angola excepted, where the Portuguese managed to convert the ruler, Christianity made no progress in Africa whatsoever, whereas Islam was rapidly splitting. In the Horn of Africa, in Madagascar, or even under the very eyes of the Portuguese on the island of Mozambique, which had, by the 18th century, become an entirely Islamic island, despite the Dominican missionaries being active there for two centuries. Yet the pull of the Islamic cities to the north was apparently far stronger than that from distant Lisbon. In short, in the early modern period, Christianity was expanding, but Islam was expanding even more rapidly. And he might, besides to these religious successes, also have pointed out that though Europeans were admittedly now trading via the Cape Route in the Islamic empires, in Safavid Persia, the Ottoman Empire, the Mughal Empire, and even, to some extent, in Mataram, the Europeans there were mere humble supplicants at the imperial courts. Practically the only leverage the European merchant companies or traders in the Ottoman Levant had over these courts was that they might block their ports. But they would then likely harm themselves more than they did those days, since they needed their trade far more badly than these empires then. For, might such an observer then say, did the Europeans after all not export silver in bulk to the Ottoman Empire or to the Safavid Empire, for the trade that was conducted via the Levant at least, the exception was the trade via the Persian Gulf, where imports exceeded exports and Persia exported bullion, that Europeans exported bullion to the Ottoman Empire or indeed to Mataram, and that was because Europeans required products of that court, but the court required no European products, perhaps except some mere gadgets, such as microscopes that were shipped case full to the East Indies for use as presents, or telescopes, or spectacles. And the Shah Jahan of the Mughal Empire was myopic. He was indeed glad with the pair of spectacles the Dutch East India Company had recalled him with. Yet these were merely gadgets. For were Indian textiles not imported to Europe by the hundreds of thousands, because they were of sturdier weft than European textiles, and thus resisted frequent washing better. In parenthesis, there is an extensive literature on Indian textiles, but nobody, myself included, ever realized that Indian textiles were sturdier when they had to be washed was the main reason they were imported in bulk, until I read it in a 17th century document, and that probably proves that the average researcher is either not a woman or rarely does laundry. Or again, did Europe not covet fine Persian silk or carpets and metalwork? Now the architectural achievements of this period have never been in doubt. Nobody would contest the Taj Mahal, the Blue or Sinan's Mosque in Istanbul, or the grand edifices surrounding the Maidan-i Shah in Isfahan, such as the Lutfali Mosque, shown in the illustration to this lecture, are the very pinnacles of Islamic architecture. Until very recently, students of Islamic literature have been less enthusiastic about either the Persian poetry or the Islamic Passion Theater that was written under the Safavids and the Mughals. Those Safavid poems, or the poems of the Indian style, as it was called, delight in using very ornate rhymes and recondite allusions, which are very difficult to grasp for non-Persian speakers, though Iranians themselves delight in them. Much as frankly, the supposed classic French literature used by the Grand Siècle, Molière excepted, is also virtually indigestible to anybody but native speakers of French. However, the true great achievement of the Islamic empires was the establishment of a literature in the vernacular, next to the classic languages of Islam, Persian and Arabic, in Ottoman Turkish, in Uzbek Turkish, and above all, in the language of the Mughal court, or literally, the language of the army, Urdu. And while I'm hard-pressed to think of any European king, besides Prussia's Frederick II, who has any literary accomplishments to his credits, several Mughal rulers, as well as Ibrahim Adil Shah of Bijapur in the Deccan and his daughter, are classical poets of Urdu. And that indeed speaks volumes for the high level of culture attained and maintained at the Mughal court right into the 19th century. For the last ruler of the Mughal Empire, Bahadur Shah Zafar, who was deposed and tried by the British in 858, is still a very beloved Urdu poet, as familiar to Urdu speakers as, say, Dickens or Mark Twain are to English speakers. Or for that matter, at the Safavid court, for Shah Ismail was the founder of literary Azari Turkish. This cultural flowering, furthermore, has had a considerable impact on European culture, far more than Europeans commonly realize. Thus, for example, Mughal Empire Emperor Akbar the Great had put up a special school or university for translating classic Sanskrit works, often already available in Arabic, but merely as excerpts, in Persian. And as Persian, the language of both diplomacy and polite conversation, vast swathes of the Orient, was widely studied in Europe, it was translated into several European languages. Those translations have influenced many European writers, such as the classic collection of fables, the Panchatantra, that inspired the fables of La Fontaine in turn. Again, the use of the pyjama is a use Europeans imported from India in the 17th century. So is the handkerchief, so is the couch, an 18th century import from either Turkey or India. So is the veranda. And one can go on and on, ranging from tulips, and indeed the entire use of saying it with flowers in Europe or the USA, to the consumption of coffee. In other words, much of what the Europeans nowadays would consider civilized living is an import from Islamic high culture during the second golden age of Islam. Furthermore, and here I have to speak with caution, for it does not apply to India, and the Ottoman Empire, furthermore, was a very big place, and parts of it were depressed and poor, particularly the frontier provinces in the Balkans, such as Romania or present Bosnia. If I strictly speak about the Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire, and about the more prosperous parts of Iran, not only the cultural elite, but the laboring masses too, enjoyed a standard of living that compared very favorably to that of the laboring populations in Europe, while Islamic law protected the peasants from either the kind of random dispossessions that were taking place under the enclosures or against the reduction of peasants to serfs, such as was taking place in Eastern Europe. Peasants in the Arab countries and Iran were generally free tenant farmers who paid much lower rates than they would in Europe. And furthermore, there was through an enormous and well-funded system of charities, for the rich were more or less required by law to set a considerable part of their inheritance away as endowment to charitable foundations, likely far less poverty, urban, and to a lesser extent rural, than was the case in Europe. And I'm here not comparing Aleppo or Tabriz with Naples, as rather with Amsterdam and London. Add to this an extensive system of hospitals, funded by the charities, where the doctors' medical knowledge was mostly still far superior to that of the European contemporaries. For, obviously, the circulation of blood was known to Arab physicians 400 years before being reinvented by William Harvey. So I would say that I'd rather be amongst the laboring poor of Tabriz or Aleppo in the 17th century than I would have been in Amsterdam or London. Speaking about both Ottoman and Safavid budgets of laborers, laborers were commonly not only easily able to buy food from their salaries, but could occasionally even afford luxuries, fine clothes, or expensive furniture. To which must be added that the urban guilds commonly protected laborers against unemployment. So employment was probably far more common in Europe than it was in the Safavid or Ottoman Empire. Let me add three more things in which these Islamic empires of the early modern period were arguably superior, or at least different in a way most listeners would probably rate superior to Europe, before giving some further thoughts about their weaknesses. The first is obvious, and it would probably be rated as positive by most listeners. The Islamic empires were far more tolerant of minorities than European states were. This is very obviously so, since after all, clearly, after 500 years of Muslim rule, most of the Balkans is still Orthodox. The Orthodox Christians had to pay a small tax to the Ottoman Empire for exercising their religion, but little or no force was exercised to convert them. Some in the Ottoman administration even opposed conversion, as that would materially cut into the state revenues. Actually, the Patriarch of Constantinople was invested by the Ottoman Sultan, so that the Sultan was at once the Khalif of the Muslims and supreme head of the Greek Orthodox Church, though in practice the Greek Orthodox Church was ruled by the Patriarch, without much Osmanli interference. Similarly so, the Patriarchate of the Armenian Church at Etmiadzin was under Safavid supervision, yet they rarely intervened in internal matters of the Church. The Safavids admittedly did clear parts of Armenia on the Ottoman border, rather to deny the Ottoman army supplies than as a form of religious persecution, and they resettled the inhabitants of those zones in the Armenian suburb of near Julfa, next to Isfahan. But the Armenians there were not persecuted, rather they were especially favored by the administration. The Safavids, in fact, signed special treaties that secured privileges to Armenian merchants resident in Europe, in return for allowing European merchants in their territory. And as a further, and likely more familiar illustration, After the expulsion from Spain, most Spanish Orthodox Jews went to the Ottoman Empire on special invitation of the court of the Ottoman Empire, the Supreme Court. And they settled in Istanbul, in Thessaloniki, where in the beginning of the 17th century they made up the majority of the population, and in Izmir. Up to the 19th century, the Jews in the Ottoman Empire lived quietly and peacefully next to Muslim or Christian neighbors, and there was rarely any friction. And it is indeed a telling sign of the times that since the 60s of the 20th century, practically the entire Jewish community in Turkey has left for Islam, as they have become increasingly afraid of attacks. For, to repeat the previous lecture, whereas the Ottoman Empire was an empire, and empires thrive on and encourage minorities, Turkey is now a national state, and the national state demands absolute conformity from its subjects. The policy of Mughal Empire towards the Hindu majority was a bit hesitant. Akbar tried to fuse Hindu and Muslim ruling classes, and he was even toying with the idea to found a new religion, the faith in God, a religion that might fuse the best of Hindu and Islamic religion. And though his successor, Aurangzeb, stressed his Islamic piety and reintroduced the head tax on Hindus that had been abolished under Akbar, Hindus, even under Aurangzeb, still enjoyed virtually complete legal autonomy. If you went to a court of the Mughal Empire with some religious complaint involving a Hindu matter, you went to the Islamic judge, and that judge would then appoint a committee of learned Brahmins to further investigate into your case. The empire of the Mughals was an empire. It valued and thrived on diversity. Second positive note, the Islamic empires featured far more upward mobility than was possible in Europe. The Ottoman administration truly was open to all the talents, including, for that matter, Christian renegades who deserted by the thousands to the Osmanis. In the 17th century, half the Ottoman fleet was manned by Englishmen, Dutchmen, or Italians. For in the Ottoman army and navy, you could aspire to a rapid career. Whereas in Europe, positions were strictly reserved for the hereditary nobility, or more rarely, for very rich people who had enough money to raise their own army. In the Ottoman army, you might become a slave of the Sultan, for sure, who might theoretically chop off your head as it pleased him. Yet you could still make a dazzling career as the son of a tailor or a shepherd from Bulgaria. Incidentally, one disgruntled cadet on the military school of Brienne, who was of mere obscure Corsican noble descent, and would surely come no further than major in the French noble only army, for a while also considered enlisting with the Ottomans, and one can only speculate on the turn world history might have taken had he done so. He was, of course, called Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, obviously, European writer, to whom the natural order of things was that a career was something reserved for nobles only, were flabbergasted and indeed frightened by this entire system, as it of course pulled into question the whole notion that the task of governing was the exclusive responsibility of those who were prepared thereto by their hereditary blue blood. And yet some very powerful states apparently could do without blue blood. They thus elaborated, over the course of the 16th century, the idea that the Ottoman Safavid or the Mughal empires were Oriental despotisms, where the only authority were the Sultan's whims, and the ruling class had ever been ready to have their head chopped off by the Sultan, and the rest of the population were little more than slaves. Quite unlike the West, where the power of the monarch was always balanced by a hereditary aristocracy, so that the Western societies were free societies. As this later on became a major justification for colonial rule, a colonial rule that was supposed to have liberated Indian peasants from despotic exploitation, this view became incredibly influential. In fact, it is still being repeated time and time and time and time and time on again, right into the present. There is in fact still a common view that describes all the unique benefits European populations have supposedly derived from capitalism to the equally unique benefits they have derived from feudal law before, that granted to owners of property security, and a stable aristocracy that could contest the power of the king at all times. Specialists in Ottoman or the Mughal state had been contesting this view for over 40 years, and in the process they may inevitably have gone a bit overboard. While India or the Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire had something very closely resembling a local aristocracy, the upper layers of the administration were not necessarily recruited from that group, as rather more or less by merit. And in fact, it is arguable, given what I said in a previous lecture about the betrayal of the bourgeois scene, that if there was one single thing obstructing the progress of capitalism in Europe, then it were the hereditary privileges of the aristocracy. So one might say, if only Europe had disposed of something like the Ottoman or Mughal administration. Furthermore, far from the subjects being always subject to arbitrary seizure of private property by the state, private property was actually scrupulously protected by Islamic courts. Third, the Islamic empires also achieved a remarkable degree of internal pacification of the empire. Most notably, the Safavids did. And during the reign of Abbas the Great, the saying was that a girl carrying a lump of coal on her head could travel the length and breadth of the Safavid Empire without any risk of harassment. The Mughal Empire and the Ottoman Empire were obviously more dangerous places. Obviously, but it has proven hard for any regime, even the communist hardliners of Enver Hoxha, to ever pacify the rough mountains of Albania, where practically every house is a castle and matters are settled by blood feuds stretching over many generations. However, if one looks at the Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire, or for that matter, vast stretches of the Ganges Valley or Gujarat province or India, the general impression is one of reasonable stability and tranquility. There were, to be sure, robbers, but robbers followed very precise set rules. When, where, and how they were going to rob you, and if you were going to travel by caravan in India, you could take up all risk insurance to insure against robbers, part of which was then paid to the robbers in advance. There was, to be sure, occasional bitter fighting at the borders of the Ottoman or the Mughal Empire. But for the Arab countries, remote from the Balkans or the Crimea, or indeed from the at times tumultuous politics of Istanbul, the Ottoman period was an age of relative rest and of tranquility, stretching the whole stretch from the 16th to the 20th century. And the Arab countries are really still longing for that stability right down to the present. Though it is fair to add, this was always somewhat less true for Iraq. That was a chaotic place. Everybody there cherished their mutual hatred. Now, despite these achievements, all three Islamic empires began to slip into a prolonged crisis at some point. And historians have endlessly argued when that was. For the Mughal Empire, there is a general consensus, me including, that the decline set in at the death of Emperor Aurangzeb in 1707. Precisely as the empire had reached its greatest ever territorial extent, covering all of India, only Kerala excepted. And maybe that great territorial extent was to an extent also its weakness. It had become so large that later on it began to fall apart again in smaller successor states. That was simply easier to rule than having to do everything from Delhi or from some spot in the Deccan, as Aurangzeb moved around all of his time. Another weakness, besides, was the empire's precise strength, namely its willingness to recruit capable men of whatever background, including, for the purpose, Portuguese Christians, of whom there were often more under the Mughal banners than there were under the flag of the House of Hafiz. However, the empire had attracted so much hirelings by 1700 that there were simply not enough lands, peasants, or resources available to divide amongst them. And that led to increasingly bitter factional fighting amongst the Mughal nobility, and it furthermore exhausted the treasury, as successive rulers had to appease all these factions. Now, regarding the Ottoman Empire, back in the 1950s, it used to be argued that the decline of the Ottoman Empire started already in the 16th century, and more precisely, it was always dated to the Austrian-Ottoman Peace of Sivas Torok of 1606, when the Ottoman Empire, for the first time, titled the Habsburg ruler as Caesar or Emperor, and thus granted them equal status to the Ottoman Empire. However, as the empire then lasted for another 300 years, one may in that case well wonder whether the empire was ever not in decline. There is, in fact, now a view amongst some Ottoman scholars that the empire always thrived. Yet that is, in my view, given the prodigious series of defeats it suffered in the 18th century, a bit over the top. 2. The empire showed remarkable resilience, but it was surely far less awe-inspiring in the 18th than it had been in the 16th century. Far more reasonable seems to date the beginning of the Ottoman decline with the Treaty of Karlovice in 1699, when the Ottomans ceded most of Hungary to the Austrians. Or again, and that's what I'm personally inclined to, it can be dated to the year 1723. And in my view, 1723 is one of the big dates in world history, comparable to 1789 or indeed to 1970. In that year, the city of Isfahan fell to a host of Afghan insurgents. This was not only the beginning of the modern kingdom of Afghanistan, but the subsequent failure of the Afghans to consolidate their rule led to the restoration of the Persian monarchy. And then, after he had disposed the puppet Safavid ruler Shah Tahmasp II to a military dictatorship under the awesome figure of Nadir Shah. Nadir Shah was arguably one of the greatest military commanders of all times. He was actually a highwayman by profession. So that's probably a better preparation for becoming a soldier than a military academy, with all his pyramids of skulls and all his bloodbaths. Nadir Shah somewhat resembled Tamerlane, and he had clearly modeled himself on Tamerlane too. So, just like Tamerlane, he led an interminable series of wars with the Afghans, with the Mughal Empire, with the Uzbek Khaganate, and with the Ottomans. Nadir utterly smashed the Mughal Empire's army. He torched Delhi, and then he left again, reinstating the Mughal Emperor he had taken captive as a puppet emperor. Later on, he also smashed the army of the Uzbek Khaganate, and he torched Samarkand. The Ottomans, with great difficulties, managed to resist a Persian invasion. Yet they were for 20 years entirely preoccupied by their eastern border. And that allowed both Austria and Russia time to consolidate their previous conquest. But this long Persian war severely weakened the Ottoman Empire's army, and it virtually bankrupted the Ottoman Empire besides. The Mughal Empire was, after its army had been annihilated by Nadir Shah and the emperor taken prisoner, broke beyond repair. So that provincial governors began everywhere to declare themselves independent. The problem was that since all these rulers were really illegitimate usurpers, they ceaselessly fought one another. And they began to search for aid with anybody who would help them, including mercenaries and commercial organizations that could provide mercenaries, such as the French East India Company, who, when supporting one pretender to the throne of Hyderabad against another pretender, not only found out that if Indian troops were more or less equally balanced in number, a small number of trained European troops could make a major difference, but also that, if successful, such an attempt could reap big rewards for the company, but above all for its personnel and soldiers. Now, in defense of Nadir Shah, I must immediately say that Nadir did not want to be a destroyer. He had actually intended to construct a powerful, centralized state, and had started a comprehensive program to buy, or rather, because everybody was afraid of him, extort technology from the Dutch or the English East India Company. However, this entire program was cut short when he was murdered by what would now likely be called a suicide commando, and the Iran then lapsed into chaos for more than 50 years. One must always be aware of routes not taken. And this is one case where I'm frankly struck by the sheer degree of coincidence of all this. The Afghan revolt started as a rather minor affair around the city of Kandahar. and it could easily have been suppressed. Had the Safavids immediately sent a large army there. However, the Safavid court nobles either saw the revolt as no threat at all, or they would not allow one of the other nobles the honor of extinguishing it. So that finally nobody did anything until it was really already too late. But the ruler, Shah Sultan Husayn, was one of those kind of kings who much resent being king. He was much more interested in painting and in building than in ruling. Had the Safavids repressed the revolt, the Mughal Empire might not have disintegrated, and thus there would not have been a British Empire in India. The Ottoman Empire would have been offered a critical time of respite for updating and reforming its military. And had Nadir Shah not been murdered, Persia might have evolved into a powerful, centralized monarchy that would likely have started expanding into India, and that might have cut short any British aspiration there. At any rate, when Nadir was murdered, Iran fell for nearly 50 years apart in Khanites and Khaganates, who were all contending for the former Safavid throne. And all that contributed to a deep impoverishment of Iran, that in the 17th century had been a wealthy and prospering country. As Fath Ali Khan Qajar, in the 80s of the 18th century, re-established central authority in Iran. On the one hand, the country had been bled dry by the Afghan invasion, then by Nadir Shah's incessant wars, and then by the chaos. And on the other, the former Safavid protectorates in the Caucasus chose eggs for them. While his father Temuras had still acted as a viceroy of Isfahan, the new king of Georgia, Irakle II, in 1762 turned to Russia to aid him in warding off constant Persian attacks. And he signed a treaty in 1783 in which Georgia now became a protectorate of Russia. For Russia was the rising star in Asia, and we shall deal with it in the next episode.